So, Brukhima Bayim, my name is Rick Eisenberg. I'm a part-time rabbi at a little synagogue in Litchfield County, Connecticut. I'm very happy to have the opportunity to be moderator for this panel. And one of the reasons for that, just by way of a very brief self-reflection, is that my full-time work is as a rehabilitation counselor in a substance abuse treatment clinic in New Haven. So one of the reasons I'm interested in hearing from our colleagues today is because where I work, we're an outpatient clinic, and we are very much interested in engagement and retention. And because much of what we do is opiate replacement therapy, so that we're providing methadone or suboxone services for people who are dependent upon opiates, we want to see that they can stay in treatment, first engage in treatment, and then stay in treatment as long as possible, or until they're stabilized, well stabilized, and before we begin to talk about a termination of treatment. So this is a very important subject that can be, I'm interested in what are some of the universal applications of what our colleagues have to tell us today in terms of creating warm and welcoming communities. It applies not only to congregational life, but also to human services, mental health field, and so on. One more thing before I open it up to our panelists. In the clinic where I work, many of our clients are disenfranchised. Many of them are coming from or trying to avoid incarceration, Department of Corrections, or they're referred by Department of Children and Families. Some of them are self, or many are self-referred as well. But many are disenfranchised. And I have one young man who is really, he's among that population, and he loves to tell jokes in our group sessions. I only allow him to tell jokes that are clean jokes and have no, you know, references to, you know, whatever, ethnic, religious, or homophobic kinds of insults or anything like that. So he only tells clean jokes. And one joke he told not too long ago went like this. He said, "Why did Cinderella get kicked off the tennis court?" Does anybody know the answer to that? Why did Cinderella get kicked off the tennis court? The answer is because she kept running away from the ball. Okay. I knew it would go over. I thought it was really cute. So the reason I bring it up here wasn't really to provoke a laugh, but was simply to pose the question as to why would Cinderella, well, why did she keep feeling like she had to run away from the ball, right? Why couldn't she remain engaged on the tennis court? You know, and you know, why do members of our communities feel like they have to run away? Why can't they stay engaged and feel comfortable and well adjusted where they are and excited about where they are? And the last thing about this ridiculous joke, which you didn't find funny, is that I actually told it to one colleague that I work with, whom I work with at the clinic, and she's very literal minded. She's very concrete, and I and her name is Queenie, and I said, "Queenie, I heard this really funny joke in group. I said, why did Cinderella get kicked off the tennis court?" She said, "Why?" I said, "Because she kept running away from the ball." And Queenie asked, "Well, what was she doing on the tennis court in the first place?" I love that. You know, because the question is, why would people want to come in the first place and be involved in what we are trying to offer for them? What's the hook? What invites them? So these are some of the considerations that are going to be open on the table today. And we're going to hear from our panelists, Felipe Goodman, Andy Merrow, Randy Konigsberg, and Sharon Brouse. I'm just going to pose a quick question to each of you, and then we're going to go around, and then we're going to have some follow-up questions. So let's start with Randy. And Randy, I'd like to ask you as follows. So you've been at Temple Beth El in Birmingham for a little less than a year. You're new to the community. And as a brand new rabbi, what are some of the plans and strategies that you have come up with to create a more warm and welcoming community, and Birmingham.
The community wanted to introduce me to everybody, and they were trying to figure out what the best way to do that was. I had just come back from the community organizing seminars at the seminary, part of the RA, and I decided I would try my luck at that. So I told them, I said, we should do home meetings, but don't invite everybody, you know, just to come to one meeting or another, because then they will feel like they have to bring something. I said, pick houses that you want to hold these meetings at, and ask them to invite their friends, up to about, you know, 10, 15, maybe 20 people. Keep it relatively small. Just ask them to invite, and come meet the rabbi. And when I got there, and we were all sitting around in the big circle in the living room, I said to them, in order for me to get to know you better, just tell me, answer one of two questions. Either, what is your favorite Bethel moment? What is it that you remember that is a warm piece of history, of your own personal history, as it comes from over the years that you've been here? And the second, or ask them, what is your favorite Jewish moment? What Jewish moment do you have that you can share? And the first people who go, maybe the first one or two, would sometimes do something a little light. But it didn't stay light for very long. As we went around the room, we found that everyone was sort of digging deeper and deeper into their Jewish background to talk about. It wasn't enough to say, oh, my favorite Jewish moment was the bar mitzvah of my children. I would say, well, what about it was so important? And suddenly it was a whole different meeting. They were getting to know me, but I was really getting to know them. And at the end of it, one of them says, yeah, this is the best meeting I've been at, and nobody even asked me for money. So it was great. It turned out to be a great program.
Thanks, Randy. Andy, so about 10 years ago, I think it was?
Yes.
You came to Beth Shalom Congregation in Elkins Park, outside of Philadelphia, and you came in as a second rabbi?
I did.
As a result or part of a merger with your former congregation. So in that situation, what were some of the initiatives that you tried to implement to create a warm and welcoming congregation there?
First of all, thank you all for being here, and hopefully we'll get to the interactive part, because everyone is here because you already recognize the idea that we need to be warm and welcoming, and not just when we're in shul, but at all times. I think that, you know, the term symbolic exemplar gets pushed around a little bit as being a negative, but I really believe that our being warm and welcoming is when we're in the building, when we're on vacation, when we're out, when we're everywhere. We just have to sort of be who we are, open, warm, welcoming, excited about Judaism at all times. So that's hard for a lot of us. But I merged a very small, loving, warm, wonderful Hamish congregation into a very formal place. A place that had a lot of great programming, but a place where when you went to the morning minyan, you might have been told, that's my seat. That's someone else's seat. A place where on a Friday night, both my senior and I started the same week, the same day, and on Friday night services, we would ask people to share their brachot of the week, their blessings of the week. We had both done that at our former congregations. We were both told on separate occasions, you know, I don't care what my neighbors did. And these were people who really have helped freed Soviet Jewry, and people who have helped, who work for Israel and work. So we had to take a step back, both of us, and think about, well, how do we get our congregants to understand in a very formal, lovely, dignified place that caring about the person in the pew next to them is as important as caring about someone, you know, you're miles and miles away. We also did open meetings, 21 of them our first year, parlor meetings. And then one of the things that I think helps us, or help, is that we follow up on them. I think we all have watched an episode or two of Cheers, right? You want to go where everyone knows your name. So it's not just knowing your name, though, it's knowing your story. And I feel like that is something that our senior staff works hard at, trying to sit with people and learning their stories. But you know that. We all do that. My strategy, then, is to ask each one of our staff members to keep in their heads, what do you do personally to be warm and welcoming? And then what do you do for your department to be warm and welcoming? How do you model it for the other people who work with you and for you? And what are those small things? And then we have gone through lots and lots of changes where if you walk into our morning minion now, people will give up their seat for you. So over 10 years, we've seen a great change and a great... it is a warm and welcoming place now.
Thanks, Andy. Sharon, I think it was about 10 years ago that you were the founding rabbi of ECAR, that you started, had this mission to create an alternative worship and social justice, social action-oriented community that would target Jews at all levels of engagement in the L.A. area. So I'm curious to know. I'm sure that we can see, we can visit the website and learn a lot about it just from reading about ECAR on the website, on your website. But can you tell us personally about some of the strategies that you devised from the beginning?
Sure. Hi, everyone. So happy to be here with all of you. So just a couple of things. We try to contemplate with every communal ritual and with every program and event, what are the core values that we're trying to communicate that drive this program or this event, and how can we ground that in the most exciting, imaginative, and warmest way possible. So I'll give you a couple of examples. The first is that our first year we officially launched in July of 2004. So we're just reaching our 10-year anniversary. And we had Friday night services only, and then it was High Holy Days. And so we were sort of thrust into this this really big High Holy Day experience. And it occurred to us a couple of days before Rosh Hashanah that we were going to have Yizkor and Yom Kippur, and we didn't know how we were going to handle it. And so my executive director, who co-founded ECAR with me, said, you know, every shul has a Yizkor book. We have to do a Yizkor book. And so I really thought about it. What is the point of Yizkor? And the way that I always grew up in every shul I've ever been in, you pay $18 and it says, you know, Sharon Brous remembers Harriet Baron Brous, right? It lists the names of the people that you're remembering. So I said, really what Yizkor's about is creating space for us to hold memory and to share memory with people in community. And so, because we can remember them any day, but on Yizkor we come together in community to remember. So on Rosh Hashanah, I explained what Yizkor was, because a lot of people in the community had never experienced Yizkor before. And I said what the purpose of it was, and I asked that people would go home and write stories about their loved ones, something that they struggled with in the relationship with their loved one who has died, something really beautiful, a blessing that they left, the sound of their voice or the touch of their skin, something that they're drawn back to this year. And the day after Rosh Hashanah, we got over 100 stories that people submitted, and we bound them together in this beautiful book, and we had an artist in the community do art for the cover, and it literally transformed the community, because come Yom Kippur, we had people who, totally secular, disconnected, unaffiliated Jews, who stayed for the entire day, because they were sitting reading these stories and just weeping. And then everyone has a name tag on at services, which is a great thing. I don't know if many of you do this, but it's a really good thing. Same thing for here, but like people you've seen for years, but you can't really remember who they are. So they were finding each other and saying, oh my God, I also lost a parent in this way. Or my brother was, you know, had the same name as your brother. Or I named my child after the same rabbi that you named, you know, your child after. And it actually built community in this really beautiful way. So it's one example. I'll give you more afterwards. But the idea is to just try to pull out of the ritual what's the essence of the thing and how can we do it in a way that will actually bring people together.
Thank you, Sharon. Felipe, when was the convention in Las Vegas?
3 years ago.
3 years ago? Something like that. Felipe was our host at the LA convention in Las Vegas. It was a phenomenal convention. This one is too. Shout out to Jonathan Birkin, convention co-chair. Felipe, it also around 10 years?
16.
16, okay. And if I'm not mistaken, when you came in to your congregation in Las Vegas, Temple Beth Shalom, the congregation was in deep trouble. You were in a position where you needed to help revive a struggling congregation, and you've succeeded magnificently over the years. Curious to know now, earlier on when you first came in there, what were some of the plans that you tried to implement to make your congregation there a warm and welcoming place?
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here. I feel very humbled, actually. I first have to tell you that I was very reluctant on this subject because I think it's a very cliché type of subject, you know. We're all struggling, I think, or at least everybody I talked to with it, this concept of being warm and fuzzy and welcoming. And it's one of the most difficult things, I think, to accomplish in our professional life. So I tell you, when I first came to Las Vegas, they were this humongous congregation at one point, and they all had the tales of glory of the congregation. So the first thing that we had to do was to actually come down to earth and make people understand you cannot relive your past. You have to concentrate on the future and actually embrace the present and hope that you could actually get to be something different than what you were, because what you were brought you down severely. And that really took about 10 years of my life in Las Vegas. I mean, for the first 10 years, I was doing damage control for things I had no connection with. It's a very unique community. But what I have to tell you, though, is that part of the growth that we've had, it's been because of the growth of the city. And in the last 3 years, when we had this brutal recession, which we were the epicenter of the foreclosures, that's when the warm and fuzzy feeling really got to be tried. Because we've never experienced people not moving in. We've never experienced a summer we didn't get 100 new members. So it was kind of crazy. And I started engaging in friendships with some of the evangelical ministers around my congregation, some of these pastors. And I ended up going to a trip to Israel with them. But to make a long story short, I've been to all of their churches. And I've observed a couple of things. And, you know, we've all heard about, you know, the parking lot ministry and people who bring you in and people who, like, hug you. And that's all fine, right? There's one thing that I observed that I think is tremendous. They don't have fixed liturgy. I don't know if you've ever been to an evangelical church. There is no fixed liturgy. There are no Siddurim. So they have a worship leader who sings, and there's a lot of music, and they project all the lyrics on screens. Mm-hmm. So people don't have to struggle with a 1,000-year-old book in front of you. They don't have to wrestle with tradition. And so it is warm and inviting because it's instantaneously gratifying and spiritual. I've come to the conclusion, and maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, that part of the hurdles that we face are the things that have been built into our traditional services for so long that we do not know how to do without, and we're afraid to just say, this does not work anymore. I also have to tell you, the challenge is, how do you simplify something without trivializing? Because what I do appreciate about what we do is that we have people struggle with their connection to God. When you walk into one of these churches, it's give your burden to Jesus, he will take you, the pastor will pray for you, it's great. When you come to our shul, you hear the message, you have to work hard and all of this, and struggle, which is a fantastic part of our tradition, right? But how do you make it happen? Because the people that we're getting are the people that not necessarily relate with this anymore. And it's not in the receiving line or going around the kiddush like some of our presidents seem to think. It's in building the relationships and guiding people through this process of understanding what we're trying to do there. Another problem, right? We're tremendously outnumbered. They have 20 pastors per capita. We have one rabbi per 700 families or so. It's really, how do you build relationships? So what I'm engaging right now is I'm going to my leadership and I'm saying, listen, we all have to be warm and friendly, not only me, not only the cantor. You have to go out to people, and you have to go to funerals, you have to go to weddings, you have to be there for everyone. The only president I ever had that went to every single funeral was the first president I had when I moved to Las Vegas. And we had this shared vision that you build community by being with people, not only in the sanctuary, but throughout their lives. So that's why I think that, you know, the receiving lines are all that is great. Like when we walked into Bill Gershon's synagogue last night, it was like a suburban warm train, right? Everybody was wearing a tag. I mean, my board would love that. And it was great. Everybody smiling, shaking your hand. What happens afterwards? That's what we need to do. What happens after they all receive you? How do you make sure that the people you care for sitting next to you is okay when they go home? Or, furthermore, I had a person sitting next to another person for the last 8 years. One day, one of them went missing and says, you know that guy who sits next to me, what's his name? That's our struggle. That's what eventually will kill the ultimate brick wall in our savings.
Okay, so now I'd like to talk about resistance, one of my favorite topics. You know that the statement we've all heard, the objection that we've all heard so many times, it's never been done that way here, or we've always been doing it this way, or it just won't work. So how do we handle the resistance? And very often we learn that the more we try to struggle or buck against the resistance, we feel like we're just hitting our heads against the wall and not moving forward. But if we can take the resistance and learn from it and use it in a way that helps us to meet whoever it is more along their terms or from where they are sitting, then we can adjust our plans and create more successful initiatives. So I'd like to, now I'm not going to interrupt the flow, I'd just like to go one by one at this stage and ask each of you, again, we can start with Randy if you like, talk about some of the resistance that you have encountered, how have you adjusted to it, and how have you kind of righted the course or changed your direction and been able to continue to move forward.
One of the things that I honestly believe about congregations is that people come to synagogue for all kinds of different reasons. It's the old joke that I first heard, I guess, from Harold Kushner years and years ago, that Myron Cohen used to say that his father was an atheist, and he went to shul every Shabbos morning. And he finally, when he was a teenager, he asked his dad, he says, you're an atheist, why do you go to synagogue? He says, well, he says, people go to synagogue for lots of different reasons. My friend Ginsburg, he goes to synagogue to talk to God. He says, me, I go to synagogue to talk to Ginsburg. You know, people come for all kinds of reasons. They come to be with their friends. They come to maybe to pray a little bit. They come to hear music that they like. They come for all kinds of reasons. They come because the kiddush is good. They come for all kinds of reasons. You have to meet them where they are. That's one piece of it. I think another piece of it is that in many ways, religiously, we often forget that underneath all of that outside stuff, the reason that they say they're coming is a spiritual search. That everybody is involved in maybe different places in their lives, but they're involved, and we have to keep track of that too. We have to know that if people want to open up, we have to give them the safe space to be able to do that. In my congregation, which is just a little over 100 years old, my pushback is always, we did that before. You know, we tried that. And they say, well, how long ago was it? And usually they don't remember because that's how far back it goes. And I say, okay, so these things happen in cycles. So it's time to try it again. You know, we have to keep things new and fresh. But you know, sometimes you have to recycle the stuff. Some things that can only be done every 5-6 years. Some things that maybe 10 years on a cycle. So we tried them, and sometimes we're able to do them better because the technology has changed or whatever. So I try to keep track of what they've done before. I talk about why they stopped doing it. And a lot of times they can't even tell me why they stopped doing it. So I said that's a good reason to try it again.
Okay, I'm going to try to talk quickly because I think I answered the first question before, what my challenges were. I'll tell you how I think I fixed one challenge and then go back to the strategy piece. So that person, that person who said, I really care what happens to Soviet Jews, but I don't care what happens to Jew in the pew, she started to be really active in those Friday night, what's your bracha, when I called her. I called her the day before because I saw on the Mazel Tov list that her grandchild had graduated something. And I suggested to her on the phone that she come prepared that Friday night to talk about her granddaughter graduating college. She said, oh, people wouldn't want to know about that. I said, you know what? People really do want to know about it, and I want to know about it. And that you will help me. You will be doing me a great service if you can share that so I won't have to wait for no one to be raising their hands with what's your blessing of the week. Let me tell you, that woman has a blessing of the week now every week to share. Because once I called her and said, I really need your blessing of the week. Your blessing of the week counts. So, okay, so I'm going back, and I'm taking the time I didn't take before. So here's my number one strategy, which is clergy especially, but all of our staff need to not only sit with the popular people. So oftentimes we get there and we think that We should talk to the people who are the moneyed people, or the successful people, or the great people, or the glittery people, the pretty people, the beautiful people. But actually, I think our job, and I learned this in Judea, that there needs to be a place for everyone in the room, and that we model that by making sure at a Shabbat dinner we are all spread out. And that we are all sitting with different people. At our morning minyan, you don't see both clergy people, or when we had three or four, sitting at the same breakfast table. We want to move around. We want to show that we value each person in the room, no matter what their social status is. And in fact, it's better if I sit with the person who is poor of mental capacity and poor of finances, and show that I care about them deeply and I want to know their story. And that takes a lot of hard training against our boards, because frankly, I think our boards want us to sit with the people who have money, right? But I think that if we want to be really truly warm and welcoming, we model what it means to see each person as having been created in God's image and having a great story. Number two, and so that's the strategy that's hard. You got to get your board to understand that it's okay for me and the other clergy and all of us to be spread out. Number two, I have a great office in the building. I have the best office in the building. It looks out on the Frank Lloyd Wright beautiful structure. It has a sofa. It's beautiful. I'm never there. I use the educational concept of management by walking around. So I try to not be in my office. If I want to be somewhere writing, I go home or Starbucks. But if I'm in the building, I want to be interacting and saying hello. I'll sit with my laptop, which is usually with me, in our lobby working so that I can greet people on the way in. And not just, you don't want to just greet people. You want to say, tell me something about yourself. What is the negative about it? The negative about it is the rabbi never works. She's never in her office. Okay. But number three, the real thing is that I believe that people will ultimately feel that the place is warm if they are recognized for their gifts. And I don't mean their financial gifts. If they are recognized for their expertise and their spiritual gifts. So I believe that each one of our congregants can volunteer in a significant way in work that is meaningful, either in the community or in the synagogue community, and be valued for it and own it, and then they will feel like it is their place. The warmth will come for them, from them. They will be the owner of the project and not me. And so it behooves me and all of us to find out what each of our congregants' spiritual gifts are and time so that they can then use them. Again, what's the negative? It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time, and it also, you do it, it means you end up spending a lot of time with a few people, and then a lot of time with a few more people, and then a lot of time with a few more people. But at the beginning, you're not sort of, like Felipe said, floating around the kiddush, but instead, you're having more substantial conversations with more people, and it's hard to train your board. And then the last thing I would say is radical hospitality. Opening my home, I want every congregant to feel like they've had a meal. I actually have a congregant in this room, so that's like a little bit interesting, but you've been to my home, right? Yeah, so I want every congregant to feel like they've been at the rabbi's Shabbat table or the rabbi's sukkah, and to feel like I want to, because I do want to know what's going on in their lives. And so the last thing is, I don't think you can fake being warm and welcoming. You actually have to want to always hear other people's stories. And you have to get our boards to understand. Felipe was saying that you were saying, you have to really get our boards and people to understand that building community is really valuing each person's story. And that's long and hard and intense work.
Thanks.
Okay. So the resistance, that was the question, right? So we don't face a lot of internal resistance in our community, partially because we got to build a culture from scratch, which is, I understand, one of the great benefits of starting something on your own. One of the disadvantages is you have no photocopier, so there no resources and no location, but you can build a culture. And so for us, it was really important from the beginning to establish a culture that was imaginative and that was about risk taking. And we would talk a lot about the value of failure and public and embarrassing failure, so that really I could try and we could try new things and not have people leave if it was a disaster, but rather see that this is part of the growth of the community and be excited to come back the next week and see what we might try the next week. So it's partially about risk taking
and sort of building an environment of creativity. And I think that there's now an expectation in the community that we'll do that. The other thing is about really building a space for open discourse where people know that they're not going to agree with everything that I say on a particular topic, and that they shouldn't. And they're really okay with that. And I think that they're interested in being stimulated and thinking about things differently, and they know that I am. So I don't face a lot of people internally who say, you know, I'm disgusted that you would use that melody for a Don't Alum, except in my family. But that's what happens when your family davens in your shul. I hear about all the melodies they don't like. But outside of them, you know, really I think it's about making a space where people understand that this is a value. I want to say a word about the way that we talk to people. Our community is really a very broad spectrum, both geographically and also religiously, in terms of observance, in terms of learning. And so it was really important to us to really lower the bar for entry into the community. We wanted the most marginalized Jews to feel really welcome in this space, but also raise the bar for engagement so that it would be such a challenging and stimulating environment that Rabbi Aaron Alexander and Rabbi Brad Artson would want to come back next Shabbos because they felt like they were growing as Jews. And so it's an interest, and there's always in the room that broad spectrum of backgrounds. And so one of the things that we do is and also of observance. And so we have about 15% of the people walk to shul and everybody else drives, and some people drive an hour and a half to get to shul. So there's in terms of kashrut, in terms of Shabbat observance. So what we do, because we really don't want people to feel judged in this space about their level of observance, because I find that judgmentalism is not really helpful in building community, is that we talk a lot about the language of experimentation, spiritual experimentation. So a lot of people who are very resistant to having a rabbi make them feel like they're bad Jews. A lot of our people come and say that, you know, the reason that they left shul after their bar mitzvah is they were tired of feeling like bad Jews. But they're very open to the idea of spiritual experimentation and ritual experimentation. And so when we started this session and you asked everyone to get up and come to the front and Adina came, and I mean, you know, one or two people moved up a row, if instead we had said, because we have a kind of natural resistance to being told what to do, if instead we had said, let's do an experiment for a minute. I want to ask everyone to please stand up for a second. Okay, now everybody move up at least three rows. Thank you. You're willing. So I bet everybody in the room would have gone, because we speak to people in a way where we say something might actually happen to you if you try this, or it might not, right? Try powering down for 25 hours. And just see if it changes your life. And if it doesn't, no judgment. Go back to doing exactly what you were doing. But try it and see what might happen. So we were teaching about Shmirat HaLashon last year. And we created multiple levels of experimentation. So pick 1 hour of the day where you're not going to engage in any Lashon Hara. Or put a jar on your desk. And every time you say something or send an email that you shouldn't have said, or text message, you have to put in an amount of money that will actually hurt for tzedakah, right? And all of a sudden, we had a community that was talking about Shmirat HaLashon and not feeling like they were getting yelled at or judged. But there's an excitement because we're all trying to do something and seeing how we might grow. And I feel like that's part, the language of experimentation and the culture of not judgment but inspiration is part of what helps people feel like they're a part of the conversation and not so resistant to it.
Felipe. Thank you. So when we talk about resistance to change, I have to tell you one of my favorite quotes ever is by Emerson, who said that you're bound to fail in life multiple times, but every time you fail, you have to fail better. And fail better and better until you don't fail anymore. And in the case of Las Vegas, we fail multiple times at the same time doing the same thing. You have no idea. But one thing that you have to really overcome is the fear of failure. Because we live in a culture where failure is not acceptable, and if you fail, you're a loser, and Israel will be a friar, right? So who wants to be that? I'll give you a concrete example. We struggled tremendously about 6 years ago with bar mitzvah, age children attendance at Saturday morning services. You know, we have the rule for such and such a number of Shabbatot, or else you cannot become a bar mitzvah here or bat mitzvah. And of course, it was never enforced, so nobody cares. So we had to come up with an idea of doing something different. And I said, well, you know what? They don't want to come on Saturdays. Let's do something different. Let's meet with the entire family to study with them for 1 hour every 3 weeks. on the year of the Bar Mitzvah. If they want to do it before, let's do it before. And it creates a tremendous amount of work. When we started, there were two rabbis in Mashal. Now there's only me. So every afternoon, it's from 3 to 6:30. I'm like, I can't even answer the phone. But the truth is that it's created a tremendous culture of caring for the synagogue. And this is how we learn the stories from everybody else. I mean, like, I didn't know things about my congregants that I started discovering when I started meeting with them for study. And it really builds tremendous relationships. And we forget, I mean, this is like, should be a no-brainer. Bar mitzvah age is when they're captive. They actually want to do this. So we have to use it. I mean, and you said well. And we really learned the lesson. All the people who were opposed to us doing this were like, no, they're never in synagogue anyway, they're not going to know what's happening, it's not a show. I said, listen, give us a chance to work with them. And it took a while to convince the ritual committee and some people on the board, but eventually just did it. And it worked. I mean, I cannot tell you it's flawless because some people don't even show up to study. I mean, they show up to Shabbat, they show up to study. But it's really a clear difference from what it used to be. We've also increased that way attendance to USY things. We have teens that are engaged in Torah reading every Shabbat. I mean, in many synagogues, I know this is normal, but in my synagogue, it was really not the norm. So it's helped change things tremendously. But of course, accompanied with a horrible fear of what if we fail, then we don't have it for studying, we don't have it for Shabbat either. Mm-hmm. And that's always part of what we do.
Are you okay if we get a question from out here, is that right?
Is it?
Great, so much
I've got some questions.
As chairman of the convention, how can I deny you?
So, open to all in any particular order, but focusing on Felipe's opening remark about how what happens next. So this past Shabbos, we all model warm and welcoming, and we hope that the congregants pick up on that. Looking out on Friday night, and I see, you know, in this corner, there's a family that had a recent loss, this family that had a recent loss. I know what they're going through. They don't know each other, and I'm sitting up there leading the service, dying for them to connect because I know the chizuk would happen. This one just went to the mikveh 2 months ago. This one has been studying conversion, hadn't been shul because she didn't have her boyfriend wouldn't go with her, her Israeli boyfriend wouldn't go with her. She comes for the first time in shul, I'm starting to connect. So I'm up there, and I've modeled it, and I hug and kiss everybody, and I don't know if people do that. I highly recommend it, and if somebody sees me, I'm sorry, but I think it models genuine warmth, and we have to, affection is important. But how do I get that? You know, I want you to know you, and what I do, I run around kiddish, like a chicken without a head, and I come over here, I want you to meet this, but sometimes they leave, and I can't get them, and how do you get the next level? What do you do?
I'm going to share what I do. I love this. I love what you do, John. So we, at the Torah service, we give a blessing to each person that shares with the community what their story is. It makes the Torah service much longer, but I felt like we have this community, 75% of these people are unaffiliated, don't read Hebrew, don't know from anything, and now they're sitting in a Torah service for an hour and 15 minutes or something, and that's the time when everyone shows up, not for the beautiful shacharit, but they come late. So how are we going to make it meaningful? And I started to realize that this is our opportunity to actually make space for community. So when each person comes up, we actually share their story. I will talk about who they are in the world and what's going on in their lives, and then people find each other that way. And so it's just one of the ways to make points of connection between them. And we also, I learned this from a colleague who davens at Ikar, who lost her mother, last year. She said that it's excruciating on Shabbos morning. I think she wouldn't mind me saying it. From Cheryl Peretz. She said it's very painful on Shabbos morning to come into services and to have to daven for 3 hours before you can say Kaddish Yatom. If you come as a mourner, really, you're there because of your obligation to say Kaddish. And if you miss like Psuke, you're not going to say Kaddish for another 2.5-3 hours. So we started to add, with Aaron's approval, of course, like everything at Ikar, I think he may have snuck out. We put a mourner's Kaddish right before the Torah service. So we add, do you do it also? And what we do is I will say, if there's someone who's grieving in the community, and I'll say, like we were just, many of us were with this family this week, and I don't know if any of you know, but so-and-so lost her grandfather this week. And so it's just another moment in the service to make public whatever the experience is of the individual, to put into context the story of the individual in a communal space.
We had a song.
Ms. Marcia Lange.
So we have a couple ways. One of the ways that we do that is that we just
You know, I actually, both rabbis get off the bima frequently on Friday nights and on Saturday, and we walk around and make those introductions. Say, see that person over there? We ask first if we can do it, but both of us get up and walk around. I didn't grow up in a shul where you welcomed mourners on Friday night, but my shul now does that. It's incredibly powerful, and people come for that, and then they stay around usually during the challah and kiddush. So we do challah and kiddush, not oneg, really. And they'll talk about that. And it ends up actually that we have a couple families who started coming because of deaths, and because of deaths of young people, and they come on Friday nights to our early service and have bonded over that. And now, what we ask of people is, if you've gone through something, can you let us match you up with someone else? So when anyone has a diagnosis of anything, cancer, or their child has a mental illness, or their child had, or they have X, Y, or Z, I have a list of people who've already gone through that, who've agreed to be buddies for them. So I can then say to them, would you like a buddy? And then we can work to find, and there's sometimes they don't work, and I'll say, okay, let's try a different person in the congregation. It started because we had this spate maybe 8 years ago of tons of women with breast and ovarian cancer, and they wanted help from other women. And then we said, you know what, this can be larger. And so now it just, we will match you up with a buddy who will help you through that.
There's a couple of things. I think that it's really important. I'm gonna expand on what Andy said. It's really important to not be on the bima and to get off every chance that you can get. Somebody comes in on a Saturday morning, and and whatever time they come in, and I know that they've been in the hospital for a few weeks, and this is really their first week back. I get off the bima first chance I get and give them a big hug, welcome them back, and everybody then knows that they're there. And usually, if they hadn't hugged them already, we'll move over and see them when we go around to Torah, whenever they have an opportunity to get over there. Get off the bima. On Friday, I don't even bother with the bima. I'm just whoever's leading the service is leading the service, and I'm walking around. Sometimes I play with the little kids. Sometimes the little babies that are there. Sometimes I'll just whisper in somebody's ear, you really need to talk to somebody. Or did you know that this person, I ask somebody, where are you from? And they'll say where they're from. I said, well, you really want to talk to that person over there from the same place. And we're able to make those matches whenever you can. It's really important that we do that. The other thing I also say to everybody is that if you really want, I tell people, if you're a stranger, if you've never been in this congregation before, we really want to meet you. And that means you really need to stay after service and join us for lunch, or join us for after the service. Because if you come in and then leave and don't talk to anybody, then we don't get the chance to really meet you. I can promise you that if you stay, you'll get to meet people, and you won't have to be a stranger the next time you come. And I encourage them. I really encourage people to not just run away after services, but to stick around.
Jonathan, answering your question, and I don't know, again, part of my problem with all of this is that it's very rabbi-centered. We need to make our lay leaders aware that they have to be part of this, or else I think we're destined to fail, because we are completely outnumbered. Without them being invested in the process of caring for their own congregation, we're not going to succeed. Right? So, by the way, I love the idea of the storytelling sessions. This really works for me. Last year we did on the Tikkun LeShavuot, we did what you do for Torah reading, but we did it for people who choose to be Jewish from without Judaism and within Judaism. We had like 30 people tell their stories, and it created tremendous, tremendous empathy and bonding around the issue. It was really a wonderful thing. I believe in storytelling tremendously, but we have to make our board members be there, right? To be the catalyst too, because I also think if it all falls on our shoulders, then it becomes our community, but not theirs.
So how do you push back, Rabbi? That's what I pay you for. I'm busy. I've got a job and I have kids. You care for.
Well, you can pay me all the money in the world. We're going to fail if you don't help. See, one of the things that in Latin America, let me just tell you something. In Latin America, at least in Mexico, where I came from, I never experienced it because people are warm by nature. Right? You walk in there and everybody kisses you and hugs you, and everybody knows your business, and everybody knows who your parents are and which school you go. It's really like instantaneous. It's kind of uncomfortable sometimes, right? But there's not the person sitting on the corner by themselves, it kind of like doesn't exist, because that would be like a real weirdo you don't want to be with, because, no offense to what you said, Andy, but these people, we cling on to each other, right? So that's kind of what I'm trying to teach my lay leaders to do. You know, they have to be there for other people, not only depend on you, or it's not going to... And by the way, when they say that's what we pay you for, like, you know, come on. You can, like...
So I want to respond back to that, which is that we have gave every board member... I don't even know the name of the book. Ron Wolfson's book about being... No, the old one. The Art of Welcoming. This is already many years ago. We gave it to every board member with assignments, and then we had a board retreat day where we learned about it, and we also... But this was board members. And we did a board audit of the building, walked around, and from that came better signage and better greeters. You know, did it fix everything? No, but it did make them aware. And the fact that everyone on the board owns the book and has theoretically read it or read parts of it and did workshops with it was a good step.
Before we continue, because I know other people have questions, so just give me one moment. I just want to be sure, because I don't want to assume that everybody in the room here has a congregation. Maybe you do. Is there anybody who doesn't have a congregation? Okay. So are you already at this point in the discussion getting some ideas? Because we're very topless-oriented here. So are you getting some ideas about things that can be universally applied, you know, beyond the congregational setup? Right, because we would certainly welcome your questions and comments from the floor about that as well. Alan, did you have your hand up? Okay.
So you all touched on topics that I struggle with. One is the fact that I really like boundaries in my family, in my own home, even though it's a parsonage, that I really don't like having... This is being videotaped. But I got crap for it at the board meeting anyhow. So I don't really like having congregants in my house because I love my children, but two of the three are Beldechias. And I mean, it's documented. He's on the spectrum, and he's very unpredictable, and he's not pleasant to eat with. So he's wild. He's an 8-year-old, but he's wild in addition to that. So it's really not that pleasant to have people there or to even be with him at times during meals. So I don't really like inviting people to our home. Plus, we have a huge dog. Was pleasant, but when other people are there, not always. So this year, I did invite two people to our house for a Seder because it was actually discussed at a board meeting where they said to me, you need to invite people to your house for a Seder. And I actually said to them, you know what, my son had a breakdown in the middle of our Seder with just the five of us, which is my house, my family. So I like the boundaries. Plus, to tell you the truth, we have a 7:30 service, and I like to be just with my children at home. The other issue is it's not up to me to have them at the house because I don't do the cooking. My husband does. So to give him that extra burden of having extra people at the house, I just don't like them in our house. And, you know, it's not just... He got to know me yesterday. But it's not just them being there. I'm sure they're going to inspect all the stuff, our artwork, the alcohol my husband has. Like, it's just like, I like the boundaries. The other thing is I know people who know me, I am a warm, welcoming, genuine person, but I'm not a huggy-feely person because I'm also a huge germaphobe. So I don't go around kissing and hugging everyone because I don't like people touching me who I don't really know. But there's a way to be friendly without doing all that because, as I showed yesterday, there are boundaries. So, and people don't know how to keep those boundaries. And also, not all our congregants want to be touched either.
So I think like they say on Jeopardy, can you put that in the form of a question?
So how can you be warm and welcoming and still show that you need your own private life as a rabbi because our lives are such fish bowls? And also to just put it out there that we have to realize that not all of our people want to be touched. And we have to realize that we shouldn't be hugging and kissing everybody because people don't want to necessarily be.
Okay.
Let me answer that because I just want a piece of this. First of all, the first thing I want to say something like that is that I was very lucky early on in my career. I came across a pediatrician who was a good friend of mine. And I said, boy, you've got a tough life. I said, me, you know, people bother me all the time. But you, as a pediatrician, those new moms must be calling you day and night. And he looked at me and he said, you know, he says, yeah, he says, they would, except for in my practice, he said, it's not an emergency until I say it's an emergency. I mean, we are often victims of our own thinking, our own narrow thinking. The question is, what is Mormon welcoming is what is Mormon welcoming to you? You've got to be the one, all of us, I'm not going to pick on you again, all of us, we have to decide what we are able to do and do what we can do, what we're prepared to do to open our lives up to our congregation. I came across a rabbi once who said, you know, how is it possible to be in front of a congregation and you can't cry, you know, when you're at funerals or you're doing these moving things and you can't cry, you've got to be strong and stoic. I said, who said? I mean, where does that come from? I said, I cry in front of my congregation on Rosh Hashanah as part of what I do. You have to decide how open you're going to be. And I can encourage you. I can say you should be as open as you possibly can be. You know, you should open your homes and you should open as much as you possibly can. Right? Because it's important. It's important that you be that person. I mean, if people are inviting you to homes, you've got to invite them back. I mean, otherwise, that will end too. But you have to set your boundaries, and you have to be comfortable with that. So while we're, most of us here, pretty open people, I mean, where our lives are just out there. But I did draw the line to my children. I mean, and one of them is here somewhere. I did draw the line with my children, and I said, you know, my children are not part of this. Right? You can't criticize my children. You can't criticize my wife, right? Because that's off limits. Right? We're doing what we're doing, you know, and we're doing the best that we can, the same as you're doing the best you can. I just won't tolerate that. Somebody early on, you know, was complaining that my wife was sitting on the floor during services playing with my daughter. And the executive director, you know, said if she wasn't sitting on the floor playing with his daughter, I'd be upset. You know, and you just have to find your allies and then let them, you know, do that for you. There's going to be all kinds of people say all kinds of really rude and nasty things. So what? You know, you've got to be comfortable with who you are and where you are, and if you're comfortable with that, then just keep moving and do what you're doing, and we build those expectations, and we can set them. And we should.
Let's have one more response to Ellen's question real quick. Sharon, some people describe California as kind of a more touchy-feely atmosphere. I don't know if that's just right or not, but can you respond to Ellen's question, please?
I don't know that I have much to add.
Really? You good?
I think
we're good. Okay, who had their hand up next?
Thank you. Mike Borgo, currently from Congregation Beth Shalom in Pittsburgh, soon to be at Temple Beth Shalom in Sarasota. Sharon mentioned earlier about how she had the opportunity really to craft and build a culture from the beginning. And you know, not coming into something that was already started. Many of us, the majority of us, don't have that option and that opportunity. Have you done rituals, let's say, to sort of blow something up and start it over? And in what ways have you done it?
Sharon or
everyone? Sharon did, but everybody else. Yeah.
So I totally dismantled our social action committee. It was an act of Akira because I felt social action and social justice work in a meaningful way is part of how I see my rabbinate, and I felt that the committee wasn't structured in a way to be friendly to one another. It was structured in a way that was unhelpful. So there was a lot of tears the first 2 years on my part. I would leave because the people weren't acting towards one another in a way that felt filled with chesed. So we blew the committee up. And I think one person ended up leaving the shul eventually from it. It's now our probably highest functioning committee in the shul because we were able to then craft it anew and be able to sort of use it as an umbrella organization in the shul for all social justice chesed work. But there were some hurt feelings. And we also, the way we got people to leave the committee is that we wrote a mission statement. We had them write a mission statement, and several people on the committee wrote themselves out of the committee through the writing of the mission statement because they no longer believed in our mission statement or in how we would work. So that was like, but it took 2.5 years to do that.
Okay. So my first week in Las Vegas, there's a meeting of the ritual committee, and they're deciding whether women can wear pants from the bima. And then I'm thinking, why did I leave Mexico? I mean, seriously? That's another long story. I just couldn't take it anymore. I said to them, listen, last Shabbat there was no minion. Who are you going to enforce these rules on? I mean, there are rules, but there's no people to enforce the rules. And sometimes, this is what we do in our institutions. We have rules for things that never happen. Mm-hmm. I'll give you another example. Our services were 3.5 hour long. I figured, if I haven't been to shul, I was sitting next to a person on the plane, we've all had this conversation, what do you do for a living? You kind of like are tired of saying you're a teacher, and you say, I'm a rabbi. I haven't been to shul in 35 years, right? Well, my shul is filled with those types of people, and you're not going to come through 3.5 hours of a service. I don't want to go through 3.5 hours. I'll shoot my brains out. In Nevada, it is legal to do that. So I said, you know, seriously, no more repetition of the Amidah. We're going to cut Tzuki the Zimra, we're going to go triennial. All in the same meeting, right? They're all looking at me like, who are you? Right? And again, I said, listen, there's no people anyway, so who are you going to hurt? And eventually, you know, the fear of failing resided, and this took over, and Rishon took over. Another example, when I came, they had Yizkor after Mincha Yom Kippur, which I don't know, but in the States, some people actually did it. In the Harlow Matzor, it's actually situated in that place. Well, I never saw it in my life, and they kept telling me, oh, it's a shift in the casino so people can get to Yizkor. It was a crazy story. It didn't match up. So the reality was, they were afraid that if they didn't do that, there was going to be no Neila. So I said, you know what? Let's have some, you know what? And let's actually do Yizkor this real time. And let's add some stuff to Neila to pump it up. And we did. And now we have like an amazing Neila, right? Mm-hmm. We have an okay Yizkor, you know, what Yizkor should be. So sometimes you really have to blow up things, but you have to choose your battles, right? You cannot fight about everything. You have to really choose them.
Thank you. I would just say this, as a side piece of this, we had for luncheon after shul, we had lunch every Shabbos after shul, a full lunch for everybody. They would use these big round banquet tables, and I found that everybody was sitting at the same table every week with the same friends every week. So one week I told them, ditch the round tables, I want long tables set up as a big E.
We just did that.
You know, and just to switch it up and to, you know, to make people sit with other people. And they'll sit across from each other or next to each other, but there'll be other tables around them, and they'll see other people and talk to other people. Oh, it was like I had done something, some great, horrible thing had happened. And I had these members who had been coming for years. How can you do this? How can you change the tables? And I said, I did. And after a while, they said, why did you do it? I said, because I want you to sit with somebody else
too,
I said, you know, we really do sit with the same people every week. Right? You know? And it was different. It was a whole different feel to luncheon. And so it's still a work in progress.
So I just want to address Mike's question also, because we're really focused on self-disruption at ICAR and trying to figure out a way, even when things are going well, to sort of play with the model and turn things on their head and see what we can learn from it. And so so first, a story about Marshall Meyer, and I know some people here knew Marshall really well. But the story I heard when I got to BJ years ago was that Marshall, when he started at BJ, someone came into his office and said, like, hi, I'm Freddie Kaplan, I'm the chair of the ritual committee. And Marshall banged on the table and stood up and he said, hi, I'm Rabbi Marshall Meyer, I am the ritual committee. And I have taken that lesson very seriously. We have no such thing as a ritual committee because the spiritual leadership of the community needs to be able to make very fluid and very spontaneous decisions about the ritual life of the community. I know this is one of those things that when you go into a pre-existing space, it's very hard to establish. But and believe me, in the beginning, we had people also, they didn't have an organizational culture themselves yet. But each one of them had come from some other experience that they were upset about, and they they wanted to either replicate the thing that made them angry there because they wanted to be angry at something, or they, you know, they knew exactly what they wanted even though they'd never seen it. So, and I had people after our very first service, we had one of our founders who came in with 9 pages of notes on the Kabbalat Shabbat service. You shouldn't do this. Why did you do that one silently? I don't like this melody. Every single detail scrutinized. And I said, I'm sorry, you're going to have to trust me here, because you don't know how to build spiritual community yet. And I have spent many years in rabbinical school and in Jerusalem and in New York. I've lived in spiritual community. I know what's possible. I think I shared this at Hartman over the summer. So Lauren, maybe you'll tell me if you've heard this before. But so last year, this is one of the reasons why I think it's important for us to have the space to actually build in the moment what we think is necessary without asking for permission to change a melody or change the seating arrangement. So last year, shortly before, it was a couple hours before Kabbalat Shabbat on Friday afternoon, and I realized that I was a little bit bored. I just wasn't excited about Kabbalat Shabbat, which I love Eddie Carr, because the music's great and it's very moving, and we got to actually craft our dream service, which we did for about 8 years. And then I got really, and it's always changing and growing, but I was tired of it. And so what we did was we moved out of the big, you know, 7,000 square foot room, and we moved into a room that's more like this. And we took out all the chairs, and I put a few chairs on the side with signs on them that said, if you can stand, please do. These seats are for people who need them. And we put a couple big signs on the wall that said, discomfort is better than boredom. And then services started, and a few hundred people came in, and we had these glass doors on the back of the in the back of the room leading out to this porch area. And nobody came in the room. They were so angry, and I mean, they were mad at me for doing this, for turning their service on its head. And I kept going outside saying, please come in, please come in. Nobody would come in. It was a really very big public disaster. So we did it again the next month, and people were really angry. Oh, it's that crazy service. We called it Jerusalem style, because I remembered that the best happening of my life had been upstairs at Yakar and at Shira Chadasha, when you're packed into space where there's no room to breathe, and I'm next to Claudia, and everyone's singing at the top of their lungs, and their full heart and soul and spirit engaged. And so we called it Jerusalem style, because for me that was Jerusalem style. And we did it again. And this time people came in the room, but they stood in perfectly straight lines in a wide open space. I mean, it was tight, but they could do anything, and they all stood in perfect straight lines. And I kept saying to them, look, why are Jews so resistant to seeing what happens to the spirit when we move our bodies? So we did it again. And the third time that we did it, I will say that about a dozen of the people who were regulars on Friday night don't come anymore because they hate that service. Okay. We got about 200 new people who started coming, most of them in their 20s and 30s. On Friday night for that davening, because they absolutely love it. It's the absolute highlight of the month for us when we do the service now. Packed into this room, I call it a Jewish sweat lodge. The davening's amazing. We decided if we gelled the fluorescent lights of the JCC, it would be an even better environment. So it's like blue light in the room and no chairs, and the craziest, most beautiful davening of that I can experience. So I realized many times throughout this experience since we started this minyan that if I had to get permission from a group of people who knew nothing about davening in order to do that, if I could get the permission, after the first failure, it would have ended. And if they were really nice to me and they knew that their kid's baby naming was coming up, so they wanted to give me another, they would let me try twice. But after that, it would have been killed. We actually needed to keep trying until we could make it work, and now it's a highlight. So I feel it's partially about making space to be able to make in the moment spontaneous decisions about what you as a rabbi know is necessary for the spiritual life of the community.
We have 5 minutes left, right? Time for one more question.
Yeah. So I'm just actually, it's a perfect segue, Sharon. So I wanted to ask about space. A lot of us in the conservative movement, or at least I feel, I walk into a lot of conservative movement spaces that we're very limited and invaded by space. At the same time, I wonder whether space is a red herring. So how much of an obstacle is it? And what have you done to transform your own physical spaces to make it more welcoming?
So I probably have one of the more difficult spaces in the conservative movement. Beautiful, beautiful space designed by the architect Frank Lloyd Wright. It's 11 stories high, cavernous.
There's no flat ground. It's all stadium seating around. And it is, for us, such a big challenge. It's such an amazing challenge and such an amazing asset at the same time. Because we decided to say, you know what, we have lots of spaces that are available to us. We're going to use this when we can and when we want to. And we, at every staff meeting, the week before Shabbat services, think about which spaces we're using for which service and how we can reconfigure. So, for instance, in our beautiful main sanctuary, which seats almost 1,100, which is hard to fill, we now have a reader's table that was donated by one of our colleagues, Rabbi Phil Warmflash. In honor of his child's bat mitzvah, it is a fully accessible reader's table that goes up with a pump kind of thing. And so now we do musaf around the reader's table, and we try to really change that space. When we're in our smaller sanctuary, which seats 300, but it's still on a slant, it's really hard to be in there. Oftentimes, when me or my colleague, Rabbi David Glansberg Cranon, lead davening, we will lead standing in the middle of the space, not from the bima. And so we are leading the entire davening while standing on a slant.
Mm-hmm.
And it works, though. So, and then what we really love to do is we say, oh, you know what, it's so expensive to air condition that room or to heat that room. Let's go into the other building where we can have a flat space and put the chairs in a circle or a semicircle. And that was something that we also didn't take to the religious committee because we knew what was going to work better.
Mm-hmm.
But we also, you know, really want to appreciate the old beautiful spaces that we have. I think it is a red herring. Who said is it the question? I think it's a red herring. I think whatever space you have, learn how to work in it.
Mm-hmm.
And learn how to fill it with music. Or like sometimes we'll put ropes so that you can only sit in a couple sections and they won't always be the front sections. Sometimes we'll just do the back sections and like what Sharon's doing, change it up and just change people's perspective.
Let me just add to this that there's two things I think that really, you know, that limit us very, very seriously. One is fixed seats and the other is a fixed seat door. I've watched people create these magnificent musical Shabbats and then have somebody, you know, get some money so they can put a special seat door together for it, and it kills the service.
Mm-hmm.
You know, within a year, you know, then people are tired of it, and then you've got this book that you got to use because the guy paid for it. You know what I mean? If you're remodeling, cleaning, remodeling, think movable seats and find ways. If you're going to use the seat door, get the most maximum seat door you can, so you can just flip through whatever pages you want to, that you can go to wherever you need to go to, and just keep things. I'm very fortunate in the fact that we have lay-led services, and I never know who's going to show up to lead services. I mean, I know I can look it up, but I mean, each week somebody different's leading the service, they all have different skills. So my service is never the same twice because it's just impossible. You know, there's always somebody different leading it, and they just can't do what the guy last week did. So and so I just say, well, what are you going to do this week? And I just build a service around them on the spot.
Just one thing to add. I think that the sanctuary has really done us in. And I have an experiment that we do very often in Las Vegas. We daven outside a lot, especially starting May. I mean, we don't have high winds, it's very cool. But listen, we've been davening in August outside, 110 degrees. It's 7:30, so it's, you know, it's like 95. But you can have... Yes, right. You can have 300 people out there, kids running around, screaming. Nobody minds the children, right? When you're in an open space, it's like people don't care that there are children running around. And they're sweating, we're sweating, but everybody's davening, everybody's singing. It's the most beautiful davening we do, is outside those walls. So we doubled as a congregation in size when we were not in our sanctuary, we were at the gym. That's when we doubled in size. And I think it has a lot to do with the space. So I'm very jealous of Sharon sometimes because I think the space confines us beyond those walls.
Mm-hmm. I obviously think space matters a lot, and we would not, my one restriction was when we were looking for a space that could hold us when we started that we would not go to a place that had chairs rooted to the ground because you have to be free to move things around and experiment and try different shapes and different formations and fail and see what happens when you fail. But at the same time, we daven in, I mean, love that you're jealous of my space issues. We're like, we are desperate to have space, but we're not rooted. Yes. So we daven Yamim Nor Eim in a gym, and it's not a beautiful like brand new JCC gym. It's a kind of like crummy, rotten, old 1950s gym. Okay, I used to call it developing world standard until I went to Liberia, and I don't say that anymore, but it's not a beautiful space. And so, you know, we do, because it's hard, it's not about the space, it's about the spirit, but the space can totally work against you. So we pipe and drape the place, and then I realize there's still all these basketball hoops hanging over us, and it's challenging for, you know, for Yom Kippur, it's Ne'ilah, and so we did a few things. Like, I put some of the things that I want people to, that move me, just a sentence or a pasuk that really stirs the heart, we just blew them up and put them on big signs all around the pipe and drape, and we tried to, like, turn the space into an inspiring space, to use the limitations to our advantage. And actually, one year we had, the theme was Get Unstuck, and it was about how Yamim Noraim is about unsticking us from our, you know, paralysis, spiritual and otherwise. And so there are these game, you know, big neon game boards on both sides of the gym. And so we started at the beginning of Erev Rosh Hashanah, and it said, like, stuck versus unstuck. And we were able to put up those as team titles, and it was, you know, 100 to 0 or 99 to 0. And then over the course of the Yamim Noraim, in between each day, we changed it. So it was like 50-50 as you entered Kol Nidre. And then by the end of Ne'ilah, we changed the game board. So we try to use the space. So in other words, everyone became unstuck by the end. Yes? No? Not. Yeah, you got it. Thanks, Lauren. Thank you. So to use the limitations of the space to try to think about what the experience of the people is going to be as they go in there.
Thank you. Felipe, I'm glad that you found a good slot for your Yisker service.
It's great slot. It's a normal one.
I'd like to close. You don't like my jokes today. It's okay. I would like to just close by saying that even though I may be the oldest person on this dais, the panelists today are certainly my seniors in wisdom. I very much appreciated learning from all of you, and I know that I expressed the feelings of everyone in the room, and we thank you very much for sharing your wisdom and your innovative and very sensitive and insightful thoughts with us today.
Thank you.